I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Ever since American pop culture became obsessed with food, pretty much every role in food service has had its time in the sun, right? You've got star chefs, star line cooks, star farmers, star bakers, star sommeliers. I mean, I knew we were really going down the list when I saw articles about rock star butchers 10 years ago. But there is one food profession that has never gotten the glam squad treatment: the caterer. And I might be biased because I got my start in food service working for a caterer, but these really are some of the hardest, smartest, most bend-over-backwardest people in showbiz. I mean, think about it. It's, you know, one thing to hammer it out in a restaurant night after night, but another to have to serve hundreds or even thousands of people at one time in a location you may have never seen before, maybe even without a real kitchen, and probably for an event that is the most important day of a customer's life. So today we are all about singing the odes to the unsung heroes of cooking, the caterers. We've got a star chef who got his start hustling catering gigs, the seldom talked about history of catering in the African American community, and some how-to tips at home from America's Test Kitchen. But first, some stories behind the scenes, or behind the pipe and drape, as they say in the biz. The brothers Matt and Ted Lee are food writers and TV hosts and boiled peanut salesmen, seriously. But after many years writing about chefs and many years going to catered galas in museums and libraries where they knew there were no kitchens, they started to wonder, how'd that food get there? And so they went undercover in the catering world and came out with a new book, Hot Box. Our friend Shauna Seaver talked with them about it.
So let's start with the title here. In the catering world, what is a hot box?
So this is Matt, the older brother. I'll jump in. The hot box is an aluminum cabinet. It's about 5 feet, 9 inches high with casters on the bottom, so it rolls.
And it turns out it's actually a really crucial piece of equipment in catering. Ted, can you tell us all the different things that a hot box can do and why it's so vital to the catering industry?
Well, primarily it's for transport, right? In every catering kitchen, you have a prep shift and a fiesta shift. You prepare the food, you put it in the hot box, and it chills out in a walk-in refrigerator. And then you use that device to push the food on a box truck to a party. And then once you're at the party, it gets transformed into an oven. You pull all the food out of it, you reorganize it with sternos, you know, canned gel fuel on sheet pans, and you can create an oven that has different zones in it if you know what you're doing. And that's the key. The people who run the hot box as an oven, which is how all hot food gets prepared on site, you really have to have a lot of experience working this thing because it's, you know, it was really never designed to be an oven. It was designed just to transport food.
It's a 1970s hack of something that was used just for transport. And then Jean-Claude Nedelec at Glorious Food in the early 1970s at the Plaza Hotel realized that to move food to a place where food is not ideal, like an open field or a dusty museum vestibule, like you could actually pull off something a lot like a real oven by giving your food the color that you wanted back at the prep kitchen and then reheating it and cooking it through to temperature in a hot box. And it's all by literal touch, like you're touching the flanks of the box to kind of get a read on how warm it is or how cold it is.
Yeah. So let's say you have a gala and there's 1,400 filet mignons that you have to do. At the prep kitchen the day before, those filets would be seared in a deep fryer, about 2 dozen at a time, just to get the color on it. You know, you're not really cooking it. You're sort of par cooking it just for that sear, that beautiful color. And then it will chill out in that hot box in the walk-in. And then it'll go to the site, and once on site, it will be rewarmed to exactly the temperature they want to serve it out at.
That's fascinating. And you guys talk about in the book making the analogy of a catering kitchen kind of being like setting up a military hospital in a war zone, which seems a bit extreme, but that's what people are doing day in and day out in these places that don't have kitchens, right?
Well, right. I mean, it's so different from restaurant world is what we discovered is the strategies for cooking and the vocabulary and the mindset are truly like from another place. And, you know, at a typical restaurant, you're serving the dinner rush over a bell curve. In catering, you have to understand, and maybe you already know this implicitly, like everyone's going to be served at about the same time. That's the expectation, within about 15 minutes. And everyone's being served more or less the same thing. And so what kinds of demands does that place on the kitchen, especially a kitchen where there's typically no running water, rarely electricity, and certainly in New York City, no propane allowed. So it's this kind of improvisational, two hands tied behind your back kind of cooking that argues for a certain type of person.
What kind of person chooses this role in the food world?
That's what we really wanted to get to the heart of, I think, Shauna, was we were so drawn to the people who would choose, you know, a different venue every night, a different menu every night. All that sort of inconstancy and, you know, the lack of having a home. You know, restaurant chefs always know they're going to the house that day. People speak of restaurants as houses. And there's this, you know, house style of cooking. In catering, there really is no house. It's a different house every night. Like Matt was saying, you know, a lot of the most glittering venues in New York, whether it's the New York Public Library, the MoMA, wonderful venues, they were never designed to be venues in the first place. So there's no facilities there. You can't use the electricity. There's no running water. And it really is loading in the kitchen and the food to do the gala for 600 and then getting out by 11 p.m.
And when the two of you are choosing to embark on this catering adventure, you both started at a fairly low level, and there is this sense that you are really doing this deep dive into what almost feels like joining the ranks.
We started out at $10 an hour in the prep kitchen, and there is a very different culture in catering, within catering, between prep and fiesta. Are you prep or fiesta? And fiesta is that person who goes out at 4 p.m. to the party and does the improvisational crazy stuff and sometimes even serves. The prep shift is really interesting too, but is like a different kind of mindset. And it's about this, you know, heroic repetition. You might be, as Ted did once, slicing in half 8,000 champagne grapes for 3 hours, or mincing chives to fill 18 quart containers, and that might take 7 hours, and your fingers tips turn green.
And there's also in prep, often you don't know where that ingredient that you're processing is going. Like, where does it go? What, you have no sense that you're really not empowered with the information of knowing what party, what dish. So it's just peel these carrots for the next 4 hours. Thank you. And then on to the next task.
And the two of you come from a part of the food world where, you know, I'm just going to say, you guys are known that you have a certain clout and you choose to kind of go into this part of the food world that's unfamiliar to you. You kind of are, it feels like, kind of knocked down to the lowest level. You're making mistakes. No one really cares that you're the Lee brothers. I mean, did you think about that when you went into this? And what were those first few days like in the prep kitchen?
The first few days were horrifying and disorienting in that way when you take a new job of any kind, but with extra hazards. We entered it firsthand and like got hired because we realized we needed to truly understand it. It's a world that's almost designed to be invisible. Think about it. If, you know, you're doing your wedding and you're the client, you're the mother of the bride, and, you know, you don't want the labor that goes on to produce that wedding to be a subject at the wedding or even to be visible. And so often it's behind the pipe and drape. And what we discovered on the inside was that there was this complicated relationship that the workers themselves had with visibility and invisibility, such that invisibility sometimes worked in their favor because the specter of a huge catastrophe always hangs over catering, especially at that level where the expectations are sky high. You know, New York City, $2,000 a plate, and the conditions are quite wretched. And so in a restaurant where a fail at a particular table or with a particular dish might result in a few displeased customers that you can kind of remedy with a free bottle of wine in a catering, if that table full of desserts goes down on a soft lawn or something like that and they all end up in the grass, what do you do? You know, how do you tell the mother or the bride, like, dessert will not be served? It's and so that level of anxiety is something you have to be really comfortable with, and it's you just kind of don't want your name on the marquee.
Well, what does happen when something, I'm sure in the amount of time that you guys spent doing this, you saw some events gone wrong.
Well, that's, I mean, that's a great question.
Every caterer has the war stories.
Every caterer has the war stories, and they usually involve a sprinkler system.
In fact, one really experienced executive catering chef keeps a sprinkler head on his desk to remind him of the time, I think it was at the New York Public Library, when the hot boxes were smoking a little bit too much and set off the sprinkler system in a library. And if you've never seen that happen before, what comes out first is a rust water slurry that was raining down over their plate up line. It was during the time that they were plating up the dishes to be served for a very fancy dinner gala. And they recouped. And because one person on the team knew exactly what to do in that situation, you grab a garbage bag, you jump up on the table, and you wrap that bag around the sprinkler head, and it conducts the water down in a controlled stream rather than spraying it everywhere. That's the kind of specialized special ops knowledge you need as a caterer.
So there are so many war stories. What I was amazed, I think what we came away with being amazed is how often it goes right, you know? Mm. There's no room for error. As one of the caterers we spoke to said, you're only as good as your last souffle. There's no room for anything that's not perfection.
Well, thank you so much, you guys. This was great.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for having us.
Matt and Ted Lee are the authors of Hot Box, Inside Catering, the Food World's Riskiest Business. Shauna Seaver's new book is Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. And coming up, culinary historian Michael Twitty on the importance of catering in Black food history. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So I'm not a scholar of African-American food history, but almost every time I read about it, I see references to Black caterers, even more so than Black chefs. And to find out why that might be, I turn to someone who is immersed in African-American food history, the author Michael Twitty. Mr. Michael Twitty, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So I have always, I've always had the impression that catering, in some ways more than restaurant chefing, has had maybe a special place in African-American food history. Is that right?
It is, because during the late 18th through the majority of the 19th century, Black caterers, men and women, were a kind of cultural elite.
Huh.
They had access to the upper classes among white society. They represented the core upper middle class and wealthy class of Black society. And a time when we didn't quite have a whole lot of rights or power, it's incredible that these cooks of renown held the kind of sway over the lifeblood of their community. I mean, they employed people in their community, and they reached across the bridge to the white world in a time when, you know, we were just beginning to explore the idea of social segregation. And they transcended all of that. And so the caterer was one of the most important figures in urban life. Don't forget, we weren't, you know, people think of us mainly as a rural people, which we were. But when it came to Black urban life and urban life period, these folks were transformative.
Mm. Okay, and you said in the 18th and early 19th century. So you're talking about during the era of enslavement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is interesting because this is before there were really restaurants, right? In the sense that we know them today, right?
Back then you would have had taverns, hotels were the site of some of the earliest quote-unquote restaurants, but not the restaurant like we know it, in contemporary America.
Right, meaning those places were places where you would have something to eat, but it wasn't about culinary artistry. But a caterer for a high society function is probably asked to do more sort of culinary high-flying things.
Yeah. So what people need to understand is that, especially when it comes to early American Black cooks, they had a skill set. You know, working with British and French and Afro-Atlantic. So Afro-Atlantic, to define it for the listeners, really represents the cuisines and culture and ideas about food that were floating between British mainland North America, African-American, Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Latinx. I'm using very contemporary terms out of respect, but basically the Caribbean, Latin world, and Black North America, Black America across the Americas. There were people, individuals, ideas, recipes, going back and forth to the point where, you know, we were a multicultural people and we were influenced by the people who we cooked for. So Black cooks and Black caterers were familiar with German cuisine. You know, how could you not be if you were in, you know, the Midlands of America? Mm. How could you not be familiar with Irish food or British food or even Sephardic Jewish food, depending upon where you were, who you worked for, and who you were around? So they came with all of that on top of this incredible heritage from West Africa that filtered and trickled down in certain ways. And then they took the dishes that they learned with native ingredients like terrapin and corn and other things which were already a part of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this incredible, unceasing exploration of the food that, you know, most people were quite happy to source out to their servants. You know, it's not like today where we indulge in everyday person's ability to be a foodie. It's not the same. Mm. You kind of outsource that creativity and outsource that talent and had someone else do it for you. And these folks were extraordinary. And it wasn't just that, Francis, it was that their character is always mentioned. And 9 times out of 10, it's glowingly positive.
Hmm.
Like there's a gentleman named Othello Pollard.
That's a strong name.
Yes, I mean, we had them names back then. And he's from Boston. And they called him the politest man in Boston. He was a polished piece of ebony.
Like, that's how he was described.
Yeah.
Which is, like, sort of weird and racist sounding to my ears now. But back then, I imagined it was. You know, but to describe someone at that era was, whatever, we're describing a Black person in, like you said, glowing positive terms, which was, you know, unusual.
Yeah, but they were always, but you know, they were seen as, I don't like to use the word dandy, because that's, you know, but they were seen in that light because they had such self-respect in terms of their dress, their manners. You had to be, right? You had to be to convince people that you were just as good, if not better.
Mm.
That you were an equal in society.
Right.
You know, one time I ran into some descendants of a well-known D.C. caterer whose name escapes me at the moment. And he lived, their great-great-great-grandfather was born in the late 18th century, died roughly the time of the Civil War, maybe right before it. And they sent me an article about him. And when he was memorialized, the claim to fame was, he's a free man of color living in Washington, D.C., then a major market of enslaved people.
Mm.
And the Spanish ambassador, or somebody from Spain, comes over. The ship lands in the middle of the night. They go to his house. Think about this. You're a free man of color. You're living in Washington, D.C., in the border, right, between slavery and freedom.
Right, right.
And then they wake you up in the middle of the night, say, come on, you got to get up, with lanterns in your face. He's probably scared the hell out of him. But you know what they were doing? They were saying, you got to get up because only you can make the food for this Spanish ambassador.
Huh.
We need you to start like right now. Think about the menu, getting things together. We got to make this happen. Remember, this is before, you know, modern food equipment. This is, you know, how are we going to assemble the whole army of people to get this job done?
Right, right, right.
But think about that. I mean, these were the culinary ambassadors as well as caterers. I mean, they filled all of those roles.
Right. Do you know has that role changed over time? Is like the esteem of the caterer?
It's not the same.
It's not the same.
It's not the same. You know, the thing about it is that when we transitioned during the civil rights era from, you know, jobs that were service industry related to professional positions, that led us to compete in the mainstream society in ways we never had been allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
Those roles, those jobs, those occupations lost their luster.
Mm.
And, you know, at one point, the caterer was this glorified figure. I mean, that lasted into the 20th century. Mm. And then about the time of between World War II and the civil rights movement, it kind of goes downhill.
Mm.
You know, it's like, why do I want to serve white people? You know, people telling their children, I didn't work this hard so you could serve white people. Go be a doctor. Go be a lawyer.
Mm.
And, go be a business person.
And the irony is that the power or the prestige that the caterer had way back in the day was in some ways because of their proximity to white people, right? Because white people would engage with them and, I hate to say, let them serve them. But, you know, they were seen as being... that they could get into that world.
Yeah, but the thing about it is, when you look at the fine print, it's really not a story of servitude or submissiveness.
Mm.
There is a book called A Virginia Girl's Memories and Sketches About Her Life Before the War. And she's talking about how she talks about slavery in a kind of a glowing sort of patriarchal kind of way, like, oh, you know, we looked after them and they were always happy and they gave us little gifts and we loved to visit with them. Until she starts talking to the caterer.
This is from a white perspective.
Yes, and I realized after reading this like 3 or 4 times, she's not talking to a white caterer. She's talking to a black one in Washington, D.C. And the caterer tells her how this is going to go down. You know, it's not like they're dictating to these people. Oh, no, no, no. They are society people. They're telling them, oh, no, no, no. You're going to have this. You're going to have that. Of course, they talk them to buying the most expensive food and dishes they could possibly make and how it's going to be served. It was more than just these cooks and these chefs and these caterers were like working for white people. They had a notorious folk quality of being saucy, of being shady. Mm. You know, and you use our modern parlance, right?
Right, right.
And the white folks just took it. It was part of the cost of having great food. One of my favorite people is Chef Dorsey. And I don't know if you know about him.
No.
So he is an amazing, amazing, amazing person. He actually is enslaved in Maryland. And he escapes. And he had been, while he was like on his, you know, sojourn in freedom briefly in Philadelphia, he was doing bricklaying, he was doing this, and he was doing catering. I don't know how, but he did it.
It's a busy
and
dude.
You know what happened? They came and got him and said, no, we're taking you back to Maryland. So guess what? The abolitionists and the Quakers he had cooked for and the free black folks he had cooked for as a caterer, they went to Maryland with money and bought him and freed him. And he came back to Philadelphia. And in 1862, he's listed as a caterer. Like, he basically got his freedom on his talent.
It's amazing.
You know, it's amazing.
What an incredible history. Thank you so much, Michael.
You're quite welcome, sir.
Michael Twitty is the James Beard Award-winning author of The Cooking Gene. So with all these stories of caterers and their high wire acts, we figured it might be helpful to bring it home a little. I mean, literally, what should you know before trying to cook for and host a crowd at home? Sally Swift talked to America's Test Kitchen's Christy Morrison for their tips.
Hey, Christy Morrison, good to have you with us.
Hi, Sally. Thanks. It's great to be back.
Hey, we have been talking about catering, and we thought it would be good to come to you guys for some thinking around what people need to think about when they're feeding a crowd. And I want to give you two scenarios, and the first one is a true cocktail party where you're just doing cocktails and appetizers. What do we need to think about?
Well, you want to think about how long this is going to last. That's important.
Good point.
There has to be an end point. You want to think about seasonality, obviously, and try to, you know, want to have super heavy foods in the summer. And I think your best bet is figuring 10 to 12 pieces per person if this is an event that's going to last maybe 3 hours or so. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if it's longer than that, you might want to add some more things. If there's a lot of alcohol present, you might want to add more. Mm-hmm. And I would gauge maybe 5 or 6 appetizers.
Five or six recipes. Yeah, mm-hmm. 5 or 6 yes. different things. Okay. How do we strategize about that? What should we be thinking about when you think about 5 or 6 different things?
Well, you definitely want to plan ahead and think about what components you can make ahead. So if there are things that you can make and freeze, that's great.
Like what would you do make ahead?
Well, you know, puff pastry is always a great thing to use because it looks fancy, but you buy it in sheets and it's frozen, so you can whip it out whenever you need it. Something like a, you know, we have an asparagus puff recipe that's asparagus and goat cheese. You can bake them, freeze them, pop them back in the oven when you're ready to serve them. That's super easy.
I don't think people, yeah, lots of people don't use puff pastry. But it's pretty flexible.
It's very flexible. It's rich, so it's a little heavier, you know, in your tummy, mm-hmm. which is a good thing. Other things that you can make ahead, maybe just a day or two, something like, I love deviled eggs, and I think lots of people love deviled eggs.
Yeah, I love deviled eggs. Yep.
And you can make them and fill them, you know, the day before, and then just wait and add your, you know, your garnish, your little bacon bit or herbs or something like that right before you serve them. So that's mm-hmm. that's easy. You just want to have a mix of lighter things, heavier things. Mm-hmm. A great option that people really love is to do a cheese or a charcuterie board. Mm-hmm. It can run a little expensive.
I was going to say, cheese and salami are expensive.
But the nice thing is that it's not just cheese and salami, but also lots of fruit or dried fruit or nuts or olives. Add some, you know, mustards or chutneys or jams or something like that. So you can fill the board with more than just cheese and meat and, you know, make it a little less expensive.
And do you have ideas for ways to get the cheese costs down at all?
Absolutely. Aged cheeses tend to be more expensive. Mm-hmm. I love a good cheese log, and I'm not afraid to say it.
I love them too. I'm with you.
And I think that there are some really fun iterations of cheese balls or cheese logs that you can make. Cook's Country's developed a few different ones that use equal parts cream cheese and, you know, a stronger flavored cheese. So, you know, definitely cuts the cost down and also makes them fun and creative by rolling them in different mixtures of bacon or nuts or dates. Or
totally fun. And if you have a sculpturing background, you can really go wild.
Put the David on your cheese board. Exactly.
Exactly. That's really funny. You know, we once interviewed Nora Ephron, who used to talk about Lee Bailey, who was the Southern gentleman and Southern food writer who just had these wonderful dinner parties. And she was spent years trying to analyze what made them work. And she said she finally figured out that it was because he always did like one additional thing, like he'd make biscuits mm-hmm. or he'd make a chutney. Do you have any thoughts if you're going to do a party like this? Do you think there's like one thing that you should think about if it's fun for you to make?
Yeah, I think having something DIY is really special, and that can be your thing. And then you could take it to other parties as well. But something like, you know, making your own crackers or homemade grissini, mm-hmm. or even like making a pâté. You know, you have that cheese and charcuterie board that's full of all sorts of things that you've purchased, but then you have your own, you know, chicken liver pâté that you've made yourself. I think that definitely elevates the whole event.
Yeah, makes it fun. Okay, those are great ideas for an appetizer party. Now, what about if you're going to really host a dinner and you're going to feed, you know, a party of 8 or 10? Give us some ideas about what we should be thinking about, and we'll make our lives easier and we can actually enjoy the party.
Well, that's the goal. If you're not having fun, they're not having fun.
Yeah.
I think the basic approach is the same. You want to strategize. Mm-hmm. So think about the equipment you have in your house. Think about where things are happening in your kitchen. You know, what's going in the oven, something on the stovetop. Think about what you can serve at room temperature or that mm-hmm. doesn't require cooking, like a salad. Mm-hmm. Even bringing out something like your slow cooker or your multi-cooker that you can make a side, like mashed potatoes or butternut squash puree or something like that. That mm-hmm. can be happening separately. So you want to be sort of figuring out your game plan. Mm-hmm. And then I think that something that'll feed a crowd, like a big roast, you know, whether it's a beef tenderloin or a pork shoulder. And I think if you can think in terms of themes, you know, you could have all of the accoutrement to do tacos or do something like bosam, you know, which is like a Korean dish where you have pork and serve lettuce cups with rice and different relishes, you know, so you can kind of make this big roast go a lot mm-hmm. of ways. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite recipes that we have right now is a roasted whole side of salmon. And it cooks in the oven, but it maybe takes about half an hour. So that's mm-hmm. freeing the oven up to use for a lot of other things. So that's great.
Yeah, and that salmon sounds like it would be a very elegant and kind of a festive thing. What about, can I go back to the salad? Because,
sure.
You know, delicate greens don't really sit out. Do you have an idea for, like, the kind of greens we should be gathering if we're going to have a salad that's going to be out for a little bit?
Sure. I would go with some heartier things, like escarole or frisée, some more traditionally bitter greens. Mm-hmm. They're heartier. Even, you know, kale. Lots of people love kale in mm-hmm. salads. We've done some salads with shredded Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. And these heartier greens actually become more tender when they sit in dressing, which is a nice thing. So
you would dress the whole salad and let it sit?
I would. In fact, yeah. we've designed some salads with sitting in the dressing in mind to yeah. make the greens more tender. So yeah. it's a win-win.
And delicious. They're delicious
yes.
when they sit. Totally. Okay, last but not least, what do you do about dessert?
Well, I think you want to balance the work again. So if you've chosen the easier route with your main course, then maybe you want to do something a little more elaborate for your dessert, but still keeping it easier, something to feed a crowd, like a great sheet cake mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, a layer cake that's yeah. a lot more work and doesn't feed as many people. We have a great chocolate sheet cake with a milk chocolate frosting that's fantastic. Or we just recently published a book that's The Perfect Pie, and we have a whole chapter on slab pies, which are big pies, large format pies that are baked in a sheet pan.
They're so... I love the idea of a large format pie.
That sounds so good, right?
It does.
They're great. And you cut them in squares and you can get 20 to 24 servings out of one of those. So, you know, it's everything you like about pie, but it can feed a crowd easily.
That's a great idea. And you could do a savory one, too, for a...
Oh, for the appetizer. Yeah.
That's a great idea.
See, you know what you're doing.
Yeah. Sometimes I do. Mostly I don't. Christy, thank you so much for coming in with all these ideas.
Thanks for having me, Sally.
Christy Morrison is senior editor of Special Projects at America's Test Kitchen. And you can find a bunch of their recipes for a crowd, including roasted whole side of salmon with arugula and almond pesto, and, of course, their bacon ranch cheese ball at splendidtable.org. And coming up, Chef Kwame Amwachi and I trade some catering war stories. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Okay, so the chef, Kwame Amwachi... this guy kills me a little bit, right? Because he's not even 30, and he's out here with multiple restaurants, winning awards, and publishing page-turner memoirs. But he got his start steeped in the hustle of the home caterer. And so we asked him to talk, some real talk, about catering. Kwame Onwuachi, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
My man, look at you, man. You are a James Beard Award winner. You are a Food and Wine Best New Chef. There's a movie being made about your life. But, I think what it started for you, though, if we go back to really taking it all the way back, was watching your mom, Jewel, cook catering gigs at her home for her side hustle. Like,
yes.
Do you remember those days? Was it like,
oh, yeah.
Ma, why are you doing this cooking? It's not for us.
It was very, 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 very vivid memories of her making, you know, whether it was smoking like ribs or wings on the fire escape, or, using our tiny little oven to make like aluminum foil pans, like full of like rice, and, you know, whether it was mac and cheese or just lots of food and trying to fit it all in the fridge. But also, like, we had to help out, you know.
Yeah.
She wasn't just going to let us sit there and watch her cook all that food. So at a very young age, you know, we were thrown into the fire, thrown into the kitchen, and had to sink or swim in order to survive.
Do you remember how she got started?
Yeah, it was one of her best friends named Piku. She actually introduced my father and her together. She used to throw these big parties in Hell's Kitchen, and there used to be a lot of artists that would come through.
Mm.
So she would cater for them, and then when she couldn't really do all of the gigs, she would like pass on some stuff to my mom. So that's how she really got started into it. Was just her friend just had too much work and was like, "Do you want to do this music video for Tribe Called Quest? Do you want to cater Janet Jackson's dance rehearsal?" You know, my mom's like, "Yeah, of course."
And
that side hustle became a full-time job.
Oh, that's wild. But she was catering for Tribe Called Quest videos out of her home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't call like a, you know, whatever craft service.
Well, they don't know. I mean, I like catered for a bunch of people out of my home. You know, like, a lot of times you don't really know where the catering services are coming from.
Okay. Well, okay, so let's get to that then, because your journey to becoming a chef yourself was long and winding. Read the book, everyone. But you also kind of started professionally as like a catering hustler. How'd that happen?
That happened. Well, I remember I was walking through Soho and I was like trying to get like back into cooking. I was waiting tables and I walked into a store. The store clerk and I struck up a conversation. The store clerk happened to be the owner of the store. She was talking about the store had just opened and she was inviting me to the opening party. Mm. And I was like, "Are you like ready for it?" And she's like, "Yeah, but all I need is a caterer." And then something went off in my head, was just like, "Go for it." So I was like, "Oh, I'm a caterer," you know? Because I saw my mom do these high profile events out of the house, you know? I was like, "Okay, I could do this." So I was like, "I'm a caterer." She's like, "You're a caterer. How old are you?" And I was like, "Ma'am, that is irrelevant. I'm a caterer. Do you need catering services?" And she was like, "I really want to do these mini cheesecakes. I love strawberry cheesecake. I'm from Brooklyn. Like, I want to do these strawberry cheesecakes." I was like, "Oh, okay, cool. You want to set up a tasting?" She was like, "You know how to make like mini cheesecakes?" I was like, "Please do not disrespect me. Like, I've already told you I'm a professional. So would you like my services or not?" And she was like, "All right." And we set up a tasting. I had never made cheesecakes in my entire life. And I had to call my sister because she did all the baking for the catering company. And I stayed up all night making these damn cheesecakes, man. And if you know, like, you have to set the cheesecake before you can cut into it and find out if it's, like, curdled or it's really smooth. So,
like,
you know,
hours.
10 hours, yes, yeah. 10 hours later, and it's only like 3 or 4 trials, but it takes a long time to like bake and set and all that. So 10 hours later I finally have this perfect little cheesecake, and I did the event. I became the official caterer of the store, and you know, a couple weeks later I quit my job and sold candy on the subway in order to raise capital to really launch it.
So when you said to this woman, "Well, I'm a caterer, please don't, you know, question my authority," you had in fact never
Like, you weren't even a cook. Like, you weren't even a professional cook.
Not a professional. I mean, I worked in kitchens, but I was not I was not a chef, you know. Right. I wasn't working in a kitchen at the time. I was working in the dining room. I just was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And then, you know, that event led to another event, to another event. My mom also had a lot of, like, client contacts in New York, so she gave them all to me, and that's how I really started, you know.
Right.
Just kind of faked it till I made it.
Let's get back to those faking days, though, because I am fascinated by this. Because, like, do you remember getting gigs where you're like, yeah, I can do that, and you were just,
Yeah, man. So, like, this crazy story. Steve Stout had this book called The Tanning of America, and I got invited to, like, his book signing. It was at the Soho House. And
very fancy, like, very fancy, like, social club.
Soho House. And my a girl that I was dating had a membership to the Soho House. So she was like, oh, come to this thing. So I went there, and he was there, and he signed my book. But I was like, hey, you need a caterer? Like, at this point, I had business cards and everything, website. So I gave him my card, and he was like, oh, you're a caterer? Young brother, this is amazing. Hey, Tiffany. Like, he called his assistant over. He was like, exchange information with him. We're going to call him up and do some parties with him. I was like, I'm in. I've made it. This is it. I've done it, right? And he never called me. So it was like 3 weeks later. So I'm like, I find out that he's doing another book signing. So I go to this one on my own. You know, I buy another book. I stand in line, and I get to the front, and I'm like, hey, man, like, what's up? Like, you didn't call me. You were so excited. Like, what's going on? And I guess I was a little too forward. You know, I was very young and overly ambitious. And mm-hmm. He was like, get out of here, man. Like, I told you I was going to call you. Don't come in here in my space, like, antagonizing me. And I was like, all right, man. And I walked away, and this lady tapped me on my shoulder. And she was like, hey, you said you have a catering company. I have an event. It's called the Singularity Summit at the 92nd Street Y. And I was like, what's the Singularity Summit? And she was like, it's the meeting of all the scientists in the world where they come together and they talk about new things going on. But it's for about, like, 2,000 people. It's over 2 days. You said you have a catering company. I love supporting young entrepreneurs. And I was like, absolutely. Let me check my schedule. But let me get back to you. I'll set up a tasting if I can. I have a lot of gigs going on. And she's like, all right, okay, just get back to me. Here's my card.
I didn't watch you just accost a man at his book signing trying to get a gig.
So I call up one of my clients. Now, this is an affluent black couple in, they lived on Stryver's Row in Harlem, you know, where, like, Langston Hughes lived and all that. And they had a really dope, like, three-story home in the middle of Harlem. And, you know, they had, like, a garage and a library that looked like Beauty and the Beast. It was wild. And I was like, hey, I need to use your house. I have this big gig that I'm trying to get, but I need to act like it's my house. And they thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And they were like, all right, we'll stay upstairs. So I hit up the lady. Her name is Liz, still a good friend of mine. And I was just like, okay, I've got time tomorrow. If you want to come through, I'll cook you a couple dishes. We can talk, have some wine. And she's like, okay, all right. And so she shows up. I open the door. You know, I look like the count, you know, but I'm like 22 years old. I don't even think I'm 22 at the time. I'm maybe like 21, 20. And she comes in, and clearly she is like shocked. And she's with her partner. And I'm hoping she doesn't notice the pictures that are all around that aren't me or look like anyone in my family.
Oh, you have kids?
Yeah, exactly. I just really love my aunt and uncle and my cousins. So I have pictures of them. Like, that's what I would have said. So anyway, I bring her in, and it's over. As soon as she comes in and sits down in this kitchen with, like, this big island, and like, they designed the house themselves. Like, one of them was an architect, and the other one was a music executive. So, like, the house was crazy. So they sat down. I cooked them, I think, like, linguine with a pistachio pesto, but it was, like, with zucchini ribbons and stuff. And then I did, like, a roasted chicken with a pomegranate gastrique. And they were just like, this is where do we sign? And they wrote me a check for, like, $50,000.
Excuse me?
Yes, on the spot. And I was like, Thank you. So you said this is in a week? They were like, yeah, so just send us menus tomorrow, and then you can come and look at the space with all of your staff. You have a dining room manager and everything, right? And I'm like, yes, of course. I'll connect you all through email. Just give me a couple days, you know, because this is so tight, I'm going to need time to get my stuff together, you know? And she was like, all right. So she walked out. I call my mom. I'm like, Mom, you need to fly out here tomorrow. I have no idea what the I'm doing. Please, please come out here. I'll put you on the next flight. So the money didn't even clear. I didn't even have enough money to fly her out. So she had to come out on her own. She hit up all of her catering buddies. She knew people that worked, that had like front of the house, consultants. So they had their own staff, like front of the house staff.
Yeah.
And they had their own captains and stuff. And she brought us all together. She taught me how to, like, I remember we went to cafeteria and she's like, all right, what's your menu? And I was like, all right, I have this pistachio pesto thing, whatever. She's like, all right, you're going to need 4 gallons of pistachio pesto. Okay. You're going to need like 3 pounds of pistachios. And she went down that whole prep list, introduced me to like Restaurant Depot, and we got a kitchen and we pulled it off. But
Mama
was crazy.
Coming through.
She came through, and I remember I revealed to the lady like 4 years ago that I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't have a kitchen, and she got upset for a second because she was like, I could have lost everything. Like, I could have lost my job and everything. But all in all, she thought it was pretty funny.
Oh, man, that is wild.
Yeah.
That's
I got a ton
incredible.
Of stories.
Oh, man. That is actually one of the things I really love. So I used to work for a caterer, a couple of them actually, and truly one of my favorite jobs ever. You know, and I think a big part of it for me was always the fact that your story was wild, but like even just like in a regular catering operation where like, oh, we're doing a wedding for 200 people, you know, yada, yada. You get to be there through all these hugely important events in people's mm-hmm. lives as a fly on the wall, you know? And like,
yeah.
I, you know, when I worked in catering, I never did high profile things like that where they were like huge high stakes type mm-hmm. things. But for me, like there were 2 years where for every single weekend for like 2 years, I was at someone's wedding.
Yeah, know? Right? Isn't that a wild thing?
Yeah, and it's like, for you, it's like they're thinking this is the day where like the unicorns will sweep me up and I will like ride off in the sunset. And for you, you just like punched into work that day. So there is this, like the way I realized what was happening many years later was you were in the same room with someone, but you were actually on totally different planets, right? Like mm-hmm. their fantasy of what that day is going to be like and your reality of what that day is like is so mm-hmm. different. And every once in a while, those two planets will cross each other. And mm-hmm. everyone gets wigged out.
Yeah.
I remember one time I was at someone's wedding and people were getting very drunk, like dangerous mm-hmm. drunk. And I remember my manager saying, okay, they have 2 bars. We have definitely overserved people. Like, this is a real problem. We need people to get home safe. There's like an hour or a half hour left. Let's at least close down one of the bars so we can control the alcohol a little better.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like just discreetly closing down one of the 2 bars. The groom comes up to her and like physically like grabs her and says like, what are you doing? He's like really upset with her. And she, mm-hmm. like my manager, this woman Lisa, was like so together and with it. And she was just like an incredibly strong person. And she just looked at him, like explained to him the situation, like, and made him back off.
Nice.
But then 3 minutes later, the bride sees what's happening and mm-mm. she runs across the room screaming mm-hmm. at her saying,
oh, no.
I'm going to remember you the rest of my life. I'm going to remember you the rest of my life. You're the beep who ruined my wedding. And
oh,
I'm like, this
God.
Is happening in front of her. She starts swinging at my manager, like windmill punches. Her husband, now husband of 10 minutes, runs across, tackles her. To keep her from physically hitting the catering manager. She's on the floor screaming, you ruined my wedding.
You ruined the wedding.
The video camera's on. It is. You see some crazy things as a caterer.
Oh, man. Yeah, exactly.
All right, thanks so much for coming in, Kwame.
Great talking to you, man. Great talking to you.
Kwame Onwuachi is the chef of Kith & Kin, and Philly Wing Fry in Washington, D.C., and the author of Notes from a Young Black Chef. And that is our show for the week. Thanks so much for listening. And you know, as we head into fall event season, if you happen to see a caterer, shake their hand, will you? Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. Subscribe to a weekly podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And look for our newest Weeknight Kitchen with Melissa Clark. It's all about getting great food on your table Monday to Friday. She takes us into her kitchen and works through a recipe every week. Don't miss it. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Chip Walton is our digital producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM.